Hi, this is Maria Olson. You may know me from Trophy Heads or Starry Eyes and maybe Paranormal Activity 3. And I want to welcome you to Anthony T's Horror Show because it's an awesome show.
Hi, my name is Jessica Cameron and you're listening to Anthony T's Horror Show.
Hey, fellow horror fans. This is Troy Escamilla, the director of Party Night and Mrs. Claus, and you are listening to Anthony T's Horror Show. Enjoy.
Welcome to Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm Anthony T. This is the Best of Anthony T's Horror Show, second anniversary edition. Originally, this episode was going to happen this past August, but with everything going on here on the Doc Discussions Network, I didn't feel comfortable launching my new channel with a Best of show. So I kind of waited like pretty much 2 months to do this episode. I will have a couple of rants from this past year, along with interviews from the 2018 and 2019 Rock and Shock conventions for you people to listen, since that convention is not happening anymore. I figured I'd reflect on the 2 years I covered that convention here on this edition of the Best Of, and then I will finally get to re-airing the infamous 12-minute rant on Glenn Danzig's Veronica, a.k.a. the worst horror anthology film of all time. But first, what would a best-of show be without Jason Blum and Blumhouse Productions? If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, Jason Blum is one of the most talked about topics on this podcast, mostly in a negative way. Case in point, back on episode 34 of the podcast, where Jason Blum's remake of the slasher Black Christmas hijacked the podcast. So much so that I pretty much spent almost half a show, because I did not want but 2 segments on this trailer and the MPAA rating. And let's just say, I just went off completely. Here's part one of the Black Christmas hijack episode, where I talk about the film's trailer and the rating the film got. But first, I'm going to re-air the infamous thoughts on the trailer, which led me to form a company called Dumb House Pictures. And don't worry, that company is still in business. And yes, there will be another Dumbhouse Pictures production very soon. I can tell you that right now, because I have to talk about a certain film that was recently on the Last Drive-In Halloween Hideaway special. And I'll give you a hint. It's not Haunt. That's actually a very good film. Back to things. Enjoy the segment. Now, I have a rant I have been waiting for a very long time to get. In fact, pretty much been waiting to talk about this for like over a month now. But with all the Rock and Shock coverage, and had another episode in the can, it was very hard to get to this rant because, well, I told you I was going to be ranting about this back a month ago, and I've not had the time to do it. But now I have the time to do it, so it really needs to get out of my system because, really, it is about the most talked about topic on the show. You guessed it, Jason Blum and Blumhouse. And yes, I'm talking about their upcoming sort of remake, even though yours truly doesn't think it's a remake. I'll get to that in a second, of Black Christmas. This is the second time that the original 1974 movie Black Christmas is getting remade. It was first remade back in 2006. Now, 13 years later, it's getting remade again. And this time, it may not even be a remake of Black Christmas, as that trailer really doesn't look like a remake of the original Black Christmas. Because, first of all, I don't remember a cult in the original Black Christmas. I remember a killer stalking a sorority, but I never remembered a cult in that film. In fact, I'm almost 100% positive that there was no cult in the original Black Christmas. Yes, I'm talking the one with Margot Kidder and John Saxon in it. It really looks like Jason Blum and everybody at Blumhouse Pictures did not see the original Black Christmas, because this trailer looks nothing like the original film. You know, I complained about the Child's Play reboot. At least that trailer had Andy and Chucky. This Black Christmas trailer looks like it has no characters from the original Black Christmas. I'll even go and say this right now. This does not even look like a reboot or a remake. Seriously, it looks like a different film with Black Christmas under its title. And to make matters worse, this trailer really sucked. I'm going to say this right now. It is bad. It is like one of the worst trailers that I have ever seen for a theatrical film. First, it doesn't excite me to see it. Well, there are trailers that aren't that exciting to see. But this gives way too much away. Seriously, I don't know what the people over at Blumhouse and Jason Blum were thinking when they released this trailer to the public. Because personally, I did not need to know that there was a killer twist involving Carrie Ells. And the fact that this film is dealing with a cult and not a single killer. I would have liked to have been surprised here. Seriously. Because that is something you do not give away in the trailer. It's like it commits the cardinal sin of movie trailers. Never give away the film's twist. And this trailer does this recklessly. It is so stupid to the point where I don't want to see this film. I'm not going to see this film. Because now you're telling me it deals with a killer cult instead of a slasher. I would have liked to have known it when I went into the theater and saw the film. Not in the film's trailer. This is badly marketed. I don't know what Jason Blum and everybody else in Blumhouse thought when they saw this trailer. Because this is not a way to promote your film. By giving away the film's twist in the trailer. Now you got probably all the original Black Christmas fans upset and completely not interested in this reboot or remake, if it's even that, because it doesn't look like that in the film's trailer, that it is a reboot from the original Black Christmas. But it also gives too much away in the third act, because there are scenes in that trailer that look like it came out of the third act of the film. You never spoil the third act of the film in your trailer. Because if you do that, this film looks predictable. Why would I, as a consumer, go to the theater, put down my $10 or so, and watch this film? This is just a lazy trailer. It doesn't build any suspense, and it just looks like your average run-of-the-mill PG-13 horror film. I am not going to go see Black Christmas when it comes out in theaters. But to illustrate my point on how to make a successful trailer, I managed to find a clip from a little-known company that's probably no one has ever heard of before. In fact, this company doesn't even have a YouTube page. In fact, this company probably does not exist. Because, well, yours truly has decided to create a public service announcement. Yes, this is warranted of a public service announcement to all people who are creating trailers. Because, personally, the Black Christmas trailer really gives too much away, and I'm not going to go see this film on December 13th. That's a definite. But I took the time to do a public service announcement. In fact, I kind of filmed it, but lost the video, but managed to salvage the audio from it. Here it is, from Dumbhouse Pictures. Yes, the company is Dumbhouse Pictures. They create the great public service announcements. Ever want to know how to put a successful film trailer together? Here at Dumbhouse Pictures, we will show you how to put a successful film trailer. And you will be satisfied when you get millions and millions of dollars on your opening weekend. Number one, make sure you establish your characters and stars of the film. Definitely do this, because people want to see characters like little Johnny, as he wants characters that he can relate or be excited to see their favorite actor in their new film. Number two, make sure you have some good scenes without giving the whole entire film away. This happens with most trailers, because the producer needs to show off the big scenes, because, well, he does not care and wants to ruin the movie. Don't do that. Do not give your film away in the trailer before it comes out, because we don't want little Johnny to see the big scenes in your advertisement. We like little Johnny to beg his parents to take him to see your film and spend the $10 and $15 to see your latest epic film. Number three, never under any circumstances give away the film's twist in the trailer. By doing that, your film is doomed at the box office. As now you know what is going to happen, and little Johnny here moves on to the next film, as he has felt like he has just seen the film in your trailer. Try and add an exciting element to get your audience excited. You know, little Johnny is not happy that one of his favorite films is being remade, or he is not sure if he wants to see your film. By adding an element of excitement, even if it's only a couple of seconds, it makes little Johnny reconsider watching your film and may entice him to get his parents to get him to take him to see your film. And that means you make more money! And finally, number five, and most important, never add anything from the last third of the film. By doing that, you run the danger of giving your film away in the trailer completely. This ruins any surprises that you have in store for little Johnny and everybody that is going to see your film. Here you go, all the elements that you need to make a successful trailer. Please do the best in making the best trailer possible. Johnny, what the hell? Don't put the final frames in the trailer, you mother! Thank you for watching this video. Oh.
to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. A weekly podcast where the discussion is about the most recent horror and genre films. Intelligent talk on a genre that deserves intelligence. A conversation between co-hosts discussing not only the film, but also the connotation that the directors and screenwriters are trying to articulate. If you want more than a review, listen to Dark Discussions.
And speaking of perception, there's just one more scene I want to talk about, which is after Caleb discovers that Kyoto's a robot, Kyoto kind of peels off her skin, showing him what's underneath.
Now, wait a minute. I know where you're going with this, but tell me you weren't already thinking this 15 minutes earlier in the film. Exactly what he's thinking at that moment.
Which is he's a robot, too.
Oh, I considered the possibility.
Right, and that's what I like, is the fact that the writers were smart enough to know that this is what the audience would be thinking.
We've all seen Blade Runner.
Right. Exactly.
www.darkdiscussions.com, wherever podcasts are found.
Two of the things that I am most vocal about when it comes to the horror movie side is Jason Blum and the MPAA. When you put the two together, you get a Black Christmas film that is rated PG-13. And as you can see in this rant, I was not happy that this film was rated PG-13. Welcome back. Now, in more Black Christmas news, since I've already ranted about the trailer, got that out of my system, got that great PSA out there, I have to tell you about the news that recently hit about Black Christmas. The fact that the MPAA has rated Black Christmas, wait for it, PG-13. Are you bleeping kidding me? PG-13. Come on, a slasher film never has a PG-13 rating. If you're gonna do a slasher film that is PG-13, you might as well just make a TV movie. And I don't know who I'm going to start yelling at, because I got a couple people I want to rant about. But first, and you know what? I'll start with the writer of the film, April Wolf, who tweeted right after the news came out that Black Christmas will be rated PG-13. And I quote from April Wolf's tweet. Here's the deal. We wrote it with an R in mind. When they did the test screenings, was clear that the movie needed to be available to a younger female audience because the subject matter is timely. Also, I want to indoctrinate girls into horror. Doesn't make it less vicious. Huh? You wrote the film with an R rating in mind, but you're defending the fact that you like it, that it's PG-13. I don't get it. I really don't get it. I know that the film needed to be available to a younger female audience, but the original Black Christmas was not targeted to a younger female audience. I know you want to get young women into horror, but PG-13 horror is not going to get people into the classic horror films like The Shining, like Halloween, like the original Black Christmas. I just don't get it. You're happy that your film got repackaged? Do you care about your story? To me, this seems like corporate talk. Yes, I'm proud that my film was taken apart and given a nice clean image. That is not what the horror genre is about. Ladies and gentlemen, the horror genre is to push the boundaries and limits of cinema. And for hearing tweets like that, you're just doing corporate talk. That's what it is, corporate talk. You've offended the hardcore horror fans by doing this. So you're okay by trading this group of people for another group of people? I don't get it. Films have to be made accessible to everyone. Yes, Black Christmas should be an R rating. Because slasher films without an R rating usually don't work. We're not talking supernatural films. We're not talking Jaws. We're not talking Salem's Lot. We're talking slasher films. And in a slasher film, you need blood for the film to work. And you're proud that your remake is bloodless, and it's going to expose this new generation to horror. Because if you're exposing people to a PG-13 horror slasher, then you're not exposing them to horror. You're pretty much exposing them to a TV movie of the week. Because everything is toned down to the point where it's just boring. There's no sense of scare factor. It's just a watered-down version of the original vision. That's all I'm going to say about this. Because I'm going to now move on to Blumhouse. And yes, Jason Blum for doing this. Because thank you, Jason Blum. You've just ruined a classic horror film by making it PG-13. Let me tell you about PG-13 slasher films. These are slasher films that have little or no blood to them. By not having the key element of blood in a slasher film, it's pretty much useless, ladies and gentlemen. It's a useless and boring film. Because there is no suspense. The stakes don't feel high. And you're not scared. It's just, I don't really get why they made this film PG-13. Sure, I guess you wanted to do it again since you did it well with Happy Death Day. But Happy Death Day, for the most part, plays like a comedy as well. So it can probably get away without the blood and everything. But to have a straightforward slasher film have a PG-13 rating is a crime. It is not needed in the horror genre. We need to go back to the 80s slasher films. Films like The Mutilator, the Friday the 13th films, the Nightmare on Elm Street films, where you had blood, you had intensity, and you were scared. These PG-13 horror films are very rarely scary. The only ones that really are scary are the paranormal films, or films that deal with the supernatural and ghosts. Not slasher films, because slasher films needs to be an R. A hard R. This is why I love films like the Hatchet series. This is why I love The Bond a lot. Hell, I love Terrifier a lot, because it feels like a slasher film. This Black Christmas remake is going to be light on the blood and catering towards an audience that does not understand the original film. Come on. Is it hard for these studios to give what us horror fans want? We want hot R, bloody horror. Not PG-13, not PG, rated R. You can do it by adding a lot of blood. And it seems like Blumhouse is so afraid that it won't make money that it needs to have a scaled down version of Black Christmas to which the hardcore horror fans will not support. Because I've said in the trailer, it's already obvious that it's not like that. But to throw in some occult plot line and try to cater to people who have not seen the original film or can't see the original film. It's a disservice to the fans of the original Black Christmas. Seriously, by making this film PG-13, they've chosen to make this film so accessible to everybody that they've ignored the fact about the original Black Christmas. Because the original Black Christmas wasn't PG-13, it was rated R. And for a reason. I don't know why these studios can't cater to us horror fans. We will support great horror films. I know we didn't show up for Dr. Sleep, which still baffles me why that bombed at the box office, because I really thought that was going to do well at the box office. But how is it hard to make a $10 or $15 million rated R horror film? You probably can make your money back easily if you made a $10 to $15 million rated R horror film. And to the studio that's put out the last Halloween film and the Purge series, why are you making Black Christmas so accessible to everybody, turning off the horror fan base in hopes that you can find new viewers? Because the target audience for this Black Christmas isn't for us horror fans, that's for sure. Because it seems like Jason Blum and Blumhouse are concerned about making money off of people who have never seen the original Black Christmas. Make a film that is accessible to everyone, not for teenagers, as you're doing with this remake of Black Christmas. This has been a disaster. Seriously. This film was shot quick, plus this film was edited to the point that, we can't put out the rated R version, because we need to target it towards a demographic. I don't get major studios. Seriously. Everything has to be targeted towards a specific demographic. And this is what's hurting horror, and this is what's hurting the box office overall. Because we're all trying to cater to one demographic instead of catering to everybody. Enough with this Jason Blum rant. I'm done talking about Jason Blum, hopefully, until 2020. Because I do not want to mention Jason Blum again until 2020. Because this is ridiculous that Jason Blum has ruined a classic horror film. Every day there's a family struggling with hospital bills to care for their sick child who is fighting an illness. There's a woman who is fighting breast cancer and is having trouble making ends meet while paying for their treatment. And there are burn victims that are going through treatments to heal their deep wounds. There is a charity in the horror community that helps these people. Scares That Care is an organization that helps families deal with the bills for their child. They help women get the treatment they need to fight breast cancer, and they help people who are dealing with severe burns get the help they need to heal. Scares That Care is a 100% volunteer organization and 501c3 nonprofit charity that is dedicated to helping these people in fighting real monsters. To find out more information or to donate to Scares That Care, you can go to www.scaresthatcare.org. Every donation helps Scares That Care fight real monsters.
Hey guys, this is Steven Christina. I am the founder, owner, creator, and host of Super Retro Throwback Reviews. Are you looking for the best movie reviews, music reviews, video game reviews, and Comic-Con coverage all around? Well then look no further. Definitely check out Super Retro Throwback Reviews on YouTube and our new audio podcast, the new and improved Super Retro Throwback Reviews Audio Files version 2.0 on the following media distributors: Podbean, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, and Spotify.
Class is over, John! Time for something new and improved!
Rock and Shock was one of my favorite conventions that I would go every year. Earlier this year, before all the chaos happened and all the cons canceled, Rock and Shock announced that they ceased operations, which came as a surprise to a ton of people. Truly, I'm going to miss that convention. I loved going to Worcester, Massachusetts every year for that convention. Here are a couple of interviews from that convention from 2018 and 2019, where I interviewed author Joe Kettner and actress Sarah French. Then I'll be talking to actor William Forsythe. Then I'll go ahead to 2019 and talk with two of the people behind the scenes responsible for Terrifier, Stephen Del Sava and Jason Levy. Then I will talk to Ice Nine Kills frontman Spencer Chanez. And don't forget, Ice Nine Kills will be having a new live album coming out on December 11th called I Heard They Kill Live, which was recorded, ironically enough, at the Worcester Palladium, where the music portion of Rock and Shock used to happen when the convention was in existence. Welcome back. I'm here with author Joe Netto. Sorry about that.
No, it's KSI.
And actress Sarah French. Thank you for coming on the show. Now, I'll start with you, Joe. You have a new book out called I, Survivor, which is based on the book that was in the film Victor Crowley. How did that come about?
Well, I'm a huge Hatchet fan. Sarah and I actually drove 12 hours round trip to see Hatchet 2 in the theater that day it was out. So, in doing these shows over the years, I've got to know Adam Green pretty well. He's a friend of mine. And he just, out of the blue, contacted me and brought me in and said, listen, I'm going to tell you something. There's a new Hatchet movie coming that nobody knows about. But in it, there's a book. It's based on Andrew Young's experience from Hatchet 3 through his life. And I would like to actually write the book. And Adam had never wrote a book before. And he knew I had experience. So I jumped at the chance. It's absolutely amazing to get to work with a franchise that you've loved so much.
Now, were you also held to the level of secrecy as the cast of Victor Crowley?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I went in to meet him, the movie wasn't edited together yet. They had a few scenes together, so he showed them to me to give me a vibe, and it was amazing, because I thought the world of Hatchet was done, as most people did. And the way he was able to pull a movie out of nowhere, it's so hard to do. And he did it. I was there at the first screening, and I loved every minute of it.
Now, how long did it take for you to write this book?
The writing process took about a year and a half total. But it wasn't a consistent thing. Adam and I split the chapters. We each did 6 chapters. He would work on his, I'd work on mine, and then we'd every so often reconvene to kind of see where we're at. We had a solid draft together that we were happy with, and then Adam went around and did the Victor Crowley tour. And during that tour, he's gone on record as saying he began to get a different perspective on Andrew Young and what Andrew Young experienced. So what we did is we decided we were going to do a rewrite. We were going to revise the whole thing because we wanted to be the best it could be. It's a fake autobiography about a movie character, which doesn't usually get done. So we went in together, and the last week we worked on it doing rewrites. We put in about 100 hours that week, just reading it, refining it, making changes. But the whole process, beginning to end, was about a year and a half.
Now, has Perry Sheehan read the book?
Perry has read it, and we brought him in the first day to kind of get some of his ideas, too, on what he thought Andrew might want to do. And he was the first person to read it when it was complete, because we really wanted his feedback, since it's his character, it's his creation. And he loved it. He absolutely loved it.
Now, how has the response been for this book from Hatchet fans?
So far, really well. We had a limited run of hardcovers that sold out, and paperbacks have started moving too. I mean, I think it's, first and foremost, it's for the Hatchet fans. It really bridges Hatchet 3 and Victor Crowley. But it's also a very touching book. And although the character is not real, what he goes through is what most people go through in life. So I think even if you're not a fan of the Hatchet series, you can find something entertaining and interesting about the book for sure.
Okay, now, Sarah, I noticed in the background you have posters for a film called Rotwood. Now, what is that film about?
It's called Rotwood, and it's about 3 students going to the woods filming a documentary on something called A Curse of the Wooden Devil. And then things kind of hit the fan, and, you know, kind of see where it goes from there.
It's a creature feature.
It's more of a creature feature.
Now, what was it like working on that film?
It was great. great. You know, we worked on it. It was about a two-week shoot, a little over 2 weeks, and we were literally in the woods for almost the 2 weeks, and it was a lot of fun. It was Malibu Canyon in California. Beautiful weather, beautiful scenery. But at night, the mountain lions, bears, everything came out, so we had to be very careful filming at night.
Now, what was it like filming it in the woods compared to filming on a studio set?
You're out in the elements. You know, you have to deal, like I said, you know, wild animals. You know, you don't know what's out there. And in a studio, it's controlled, you know. But it's great being on location because you can basically do whatever you want. It feels like you have more freedom. And it feels real. Like, you can really get into character. You can really get the feel for, you know, the elements, everything. It's amazing.
Now, I also noticed you're in a film that's coming out called Death House. How did you become involved with that film?
I got that through Felissa Rose, who is a really good friend of mine. She came to me and said I'd be good for this one part, and the part was with Sid Haig, and it was great working with Sid. He's such a great actor. He's a good friend, and it was so much fun working with him and being on set with Felissa. Yeah, it was great. Definitely check out Death House. It's coming out, I think, in about a month.
I think it has its Blu-ray DVD.
Yeah, there's a Blu-ray DVD release coming up soon.
I think the VOD is November,
yep.
Blu-ray DVD December.
Yes, so definitely check that out.
Yeah, I've already seen the film.
Okay, cool.
It premiered, like, last year at ScareCon New England.
Yeah, it's had a
really good film.
Yep.
It's a very kick-ass action horror film.
You can't go wrong.
Kane Hodder's great.
Yes, I think Kane Hodder is great in this film.
Yeah, we love Kane.
One of his best films, I think.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Now, where can you find your various projects on the web and social media?
Well, for me, I do a lot of my social media through Instagram, so just look up Sarah French. Also, my website, www.sarahfrenchonline.com.
For me, any kind of the books you can find on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, anywhere you get books. My Instagram is it Joey Netter? It's Joey Netter, last name K-N-E-T-T-E-R. I have Facebook also, but we prefer Instagram because it's pictures and there's no bullshit. People are just getting along, no drama, because we both believe in being very positive and avoiding drama wherever we can, and Facebook is just so full of it.
I've noticed that too as well.
I'd rather just look at pictures of cute kitties and puppies, okay?
Now, do you also have a podcast as well?
I have a podcast I do Wednesday nights on Deep Talk Radio Network with my friend Steve Uncle Creepy Barton called Brainwaves Horror and Paranormal Talk Radio. First hour, it's a two-hour show. We're live every week. First hour is just Steve and I talking about whatever pops in our head. Second hour, we always have a guest from the horror or paranormal world. That's live Wednesday nights, 7 p.m. West Coast time. So I guess 10 p.m. out here.
On the East Coast.
Yeah.
I want to thank you, Joe and Sarah, for coming on my podcast. I hope you have a safe travel back to L.A.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and have a good day.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Welcome back. I'm now here with actor William Forsythe. He's been in such films as The Devil's Rejects and Halloween. Most recently, he can be seen in the Amazon series The Man in the High Castle. I want to thank you for coming on my show.
It's my pleasure, buddy. How you doing today?
Doing good. You?
I'm doing great, man.
How's your time at Rock and Shock, Ben, so
great
far?
Time. Always great to be in Worcester. Great to be in Mass. You know, I'm a New England fan, so I love coming.
Now, you're most known for The Devil's Rejects. What is it like to work with Rob Zombie on that film?
Well, I don't know if I'm most known for The Devil's Rejects. I'm most known in this horror circle from The Devil's Rejects. Working with Zombie, phenomenal. Rob's a smart director, a very strong director. He knows exactly what he wants, and he puts his trust in his people. So he's a real pleasure to work with.
What was it like working with actors like Sid Haig, Danny Trejo, DDP,
Bill Moseley and Sherry Moon on that film.
It's like a bunch of juvenile delinquents having a party together. It's good fun. All great, you know, great guys, like a family, and a real pleasure. I mean, every single person you mentioned is a friend, and I love working with them.
Now, besides that, you also have worked with such directors as Warren Beatty, Michael Bay, non-horror, of course. But I would love to ask that question. What is it like to work with those directors?
I've worked with a lot of great, amazing, famous directors. I worked also with Sergio Leone, John Frankenheimer, Paul Schrader. I mean, I've got quite a list. It's all a gift. I worked really hard to be an actor. I studied really hard. I wanted to be a good actor. I worked really hard. And one of the biggest perks and benefits of it is I've gotten to work with so many brilliant directors and actors through the years. And for me, that's my pleasure. I can't stand the business, but I love the work.
Now, do you have a favorite actor or director that you love to working with?
Well, it's hard to pick a favorite. It's like, which finger do you like more? There's a great selection of people. I can name a few. I mean, I love Robert Duvall. I love working with Robert De Niro. I love working with Al Pacino. I mean, those are the top headline guys. But, I mean, there's so many actors that I just absolutely love and have had the pleasure of working with.
Now, you're in the series The Man in the High Castle, which is mostly a science fiction series.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about your character in that.
Well, I can't talk too much about it other than what you can see, but of all things, I'm playing J. Edgar Hoover in Man in the High Castle, so it's essentially J. Edgar Hoover in the continuation of the Third Reich, so it's pretty out there and fun. A spectacular show. I mean, they do a really great job of capturing something grand and special, and I think the show is phenomenal, and I had a really good time working on it.
And finally, any upcoming projects that you're working on that is coming out on DVD, Blu-ray, or currently in the pipeline?
Yeah, I have quite a few things that I have done this year and last year. Right now, I have a film coming out. I believe it's February with Liam Neeson. He and I play brothers. It's called Hard Powder. I did another film called Vault. Another film called Wake Up. And actually, I've got even a couple other ones in the can. So I'm keeping busy.
That's always a good thing to hear for a character actor like you.
Don't C-word me. Don't you use the fucking C-word on me. Use the B-word. Versatile.
Versatile actor. We'll say that. I want to thank you for coming on the show, and I hope you have a safe travel home.
God bless you, brother. God bless you.
I'm here with Steven Del Salba and Jason Levy, both from Terrifier and Abnormal Attraction. How are you both doing today?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, we're doing great. Happy to stop by.
How did each of you get into the film business?
Well, I actually got into the film business largely in part because of Jason and his brother Mike, who's sitting right next to you. They've been making movies since they were little kids, and I was fortunate enough to go to school with them, become friends, and really bring out my joy and my love of photography and start turning it into filmmaking.
Me and my brother used to run around with my mom's video camera when we were kids, and I remember like it was yesterday, and I knew once we started doing it, this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And then we went to grammar school with Steve, and then we went to high school with Steve, we went to college with Steve, so it was just a relationship that formed over the years, and this is how we got, and we formed the business of Fuzz on the Lens Productions in 2010 officially, but we've been doing it ever since those high school days and grammar school days.
Now, the biggest film that both of you have been a part of is Terrifier. How did each of you get involved with Terrifier?
So we got involved through a good friend of ours, the executive producer. His name is Phil Falcone. And they were actually shooting one of these scenes at the end of the film. And he asked us to be in it. It was that simple. I mean, he just needed a few extra people to help out. No one knew that the movie was going to be what it is now. It's when it's in its infancy, and that it was going to blow up. And we were glad. We were happy to help out. As you can see, it turned into something a lot more than anyone could have ever hoped for. And now we're fortunate enough to be producing the second one and having a much bigger role in it.
With me, it was almost the same thing. We were filming this movie of Normal Attraction at the time, and Phil came on set and really liked the way we were working and saw our work ethic and our production value, and he said, hey, I'm doing this small little movie. At the time, it was small, called Terrifier. He goes, we would love to get you guys to act in it. We're trying to fill these two parts, and we want to shoot a couple pickup shots. So we said, yeah, why not? We'll do it. And then we did it, and Terrifier took off, and now we're gearing up to produce the second one with Dark Age Cinema. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Now, what was it like working with both Damien Leone and David Howard Thornton on the film?
It was a blast. I know Damien's a very sweet and genuine guy, and so is David. And they're very relaxed. They know what they want. He's very specific of the amount of gore that he wants in his movies, and we're trying to see if we can outdo the first one, definitely, so we'll see what happens. But I think it's going to be a lot gorier.
Yeah, dare I say, the second one might be better than the first, but the key is it stays true to the original. Damien is great. He's got a lot going on in his mind. It's hard to keep up with the craziness he has, and that's just our job to turn it into a reality with him now. So the second one is going to stay true to the original, have all that gore, still have that slasher feel, and obviously Art keeps his character. The humor of that clown is really important to me, and I think that sticks around, and then we take everything else to the next level. So it'll be a lot of fun.
Now, Steven, what made you want to become a producer as well, as you have your production company, Fuzz on the Lens Productions?
Well, producing to me is the most important part of making a film. I mean, everybody likes to be an actor, likes to be in front of the camera and be seen and, you know, have that notoriety. But to me, I'd rather be behind the scenes and be the one who takes it from start to finish. So you could find the director and the writer and the script and see it in its infancy and then stick with it until it's done and watch it go out into the world and see how it lasts. So I really like that aspect of being involved in all things hands-on and taking it from start to finish.
What was both of you's favorite moment on the set of Terrifier?
I guess my favorite moment on the set of Terrifier is seeing how, like, everything's done. But basically what Steve was saying, when you make any movie, you like to see, it's like having a kid. It's like seeing it when it was born and when it was created, and then watching it grow up. And in Terrifier, watching all the effects blossom into Damien's vision was the most rewarding thing, because to see the smile on his face when it was executed right, and when you're sitting down and you're watching it in a movie theater and you see the people's reactions and it's terrifying, that's what Damien wanted, and that's what Damien got.
So for me, like I said, we got involved a little bit later on in the process, and Mike, who is not here, Mike Levy, Jason's brother, he's the other founder of Fuzz on the Lens. He happens to be the exterminator who gets his head cut off, and we shot that scene with them. So we had an extra camera come in, we shot that scene, so I was really happy to be involved with that. And that, my favorite part is specifically, is watching Damien and the joy he has splashing blood all over a set. I mean, I've never seen gallons and gallons of blood come out of somebody, and then he just kept asking for more. It was everywhere. So that was my favorite part, is watching that scene come to fruition.
Now, you're probably expecting more gallons and gallons in the sequel.
Yes.
Terrifier 2.
Yes.
We gotta get big vats of blood, because Damien wants to really push the blood in this one. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot more.
There's a few interesting ways people die in this one. We can't get too far into detail, but some of them won't involve blood, but they'll still be pretty bloody, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it seemed like on his Indiegogo campaign that he wants to go even farther.
For sure.
With the sequel. Are you surprised that Terrifier has been this successful?
I'm not surprised. I mean, it's hard to say that, because anytime something does this well and starts out this small, it's surprising. But when you really think about it, what was put together deserves this. And that's why it's not that surprising. It's what people wanted, it's what they were waiting for, and they actually got it, and it was executed right. So it makes sense.
I would say the whole thing about Terrifier is these horror films today are very reliant on jump scares and ghost apparitions and things like that. And the fans just want, from when I'm traveling all over these cons, the fans want an 80s gory slasher, because that's what the horror that we all grew up loving started off as, the Nightmare on Elm Street, the Michael Myers, the Jason Voorhees, and they're putting Art the Clown up there with those iconic slashers. So it's not really surprising, because I knew once I saw the clown first and foremost up close, that is when I knew that this could be a really big iconic slasher in the industry, and it's showing that.
Both of you are here to promote your film Abnormal Attraction, which you both wrote the screenplay for.
Correct.
Tell everyone about that film.
So Abnormal Attraction is a bit of a horror comedy. It is more of a comedy than a horror, but it is about fairy tale creatures living in the real world with humans. So instead of like all the differences we have today with like race relations or something like that, it's monsters and humans not getting along and how they go about it. So it stars Malcolm McDowell, Gilbert Gottfried, Bruce Davison, Leslie Easterbrook, Ron Jeremy even has a small cameo. Lots of familiar faces you'd recognize, and maybe some you wouldn't, like Jim Hanks, who's Tom Hanks' brother, is in it as Frankenstein, or Frank Stein, actually. So it's a lot of, it's a fun movie. It's a different movie. You wouldn't see anything really like it anywhere else. So
now, what was the process in casting each of those actors?
Everybody comes together from a different way. Some people we happen to be friends with, like Tyler Mane is in it. He was Sabretooth in X-Men. He is Michael Myers. He plays the Cyclops. We met him at a film festival in Arkansas, of all places. So some people you become friends with, other people it's just through connections to whoever's manager. Like Malcolm, we're good friends with his manager. He helped us out, told him it was a movie he should be a part of. So there's just different channels for everybody.
Yeah, I would go with the same thing that Steve just said. You know, this is a business, the film business. I mean, there's so many talented people that never get discovered. And the whole idea behind the film industry is about networking. It's about meeting people at, like these cons or at different events and talking to them and just getting to know them on a personal basis. And then that's when you start to form these relationships and you start to really, you know, meet people. And you go around and you meet these actors and actresses, and you just got to realize that they're just regular human beings just like me and you, and they want to get a job and they want to work and they love the art, and that's what you got to go out and offer them.
How did you guys come up with the story for that film?
So we were sitting at a film festival called New York Horror Film Festival, and we were sitting down and we were seeing all these people dressed up, just like kind of at the convention we're at today, all these people dressed up, so we wanted to make a movie that we would like to see. And I know when I was little, I wanted to watch, I loved these movies like Halloween Town, I loved the You Afraid of the Dark, the Goosebumps, those type of monsters and humans living in the same world, because I felt like there was a lot of room for comedy in that. So we started writing the script, and the script originally started as a short film, which was only about supposed to be 20 minutes long. But then we were like, oh, why are we going to make a short film? Let's just go out and make a feature. So we went back to the writing room and made the feature, started writing the feature.
Yeah, so pretty much like Jason said, but specifically we saw these people in all these costumes, and we saw how attracted people are to these creatures, to like who's a zombie, who's a vampire, who's some kind of undead celebrity. You know, everyone's in all these crazy costumes, and people are attracted to them. People find them sexy, and we're like, I wonder if people, if we made a movie about how instead of an AA meeting where people are alcoholics and they're trying to get over this addiction, what about an addiction to weird things? An abnormal attraction to these creatures, and that's really where it blossomed from there.
Now, what was the toughest role to cast for that film?
The toughest role to cast? Oh man, that's a tough question. Specifically, one of the toughest ones to cast, I would say, is one of the leads, Dr. Cole, who ended up being played by Bruce Davison. It's a very important part. He's really what ties the whole film together. And Robert Englund was on our mind at first. He was actually going to play the part when it was a short, like we said. And then it turned into a feature, and scheduling and things changed, and it just wouldn't work out with him. So we had to find a few different channels, and we ended up being introduced to Bruce. And we're very happy that worked out, because he's a fantastic actor, and he did a great job. So he's actually an Academy Award nominated actor. And, you know, that says all you need to hear.
Now, Stephen, I also noticed that you're a producer of the upcoming Pennywise documentary, the story of it.
Yes.
How did you become involved with that?
We got involved through that, through something pretty simple that I guess would, for a lot of indie filmmakers and people could follow this suit. We heard about it on Indiegogo. They were running a campaign looking for funding, and we reached out to them and said we were big fans of the film and wanted to help out and be a part of it however we can. And, you know, one thing led to another, and then we're producers. We shot a lot of the interviews, and we're really excited. It's going to be coming out very soon.
So what was the question?
We were talking about
the Pennywise doc?
Yeah, Pennywise.
Yeah, so we met, we funded it on the, it was on Indiegogo, and we met our good friend John Campiano, who's heavily involved in it. He asked us to do a couple of the New York-based interviews. So we said, yeah, sure. I mean, I loved it when I was growing up. I loved the Tim Curry's portrayal of the clown, and I was a huge fan, me and my brother alike, and we decided, hey, we want to roll with this. It's such an iconic thing in the horror community, and we just went with it, you know?
Who is featured in the documentary?
Pretty much the entire original cast. That's
so
the easiest
Tim Curry,
way to say it.
Yeah, Tim Curry, Seth Green's in it, so they got everybody that was in the movie, besides a few smaller roles, but they got the kid that played the original Georgie's in it, they got all the kids that played the little kids in the movie, and they got some of the adults as well, and they got the cinematographer and the director and everything.
Even interesting people you might not think of, like the person who designed the poster art and deeper down the line like that, so it's a lot of knowledge you're not going to find anywhere else.
When can we expect this documentary to come out?
By the end of this year. I can't give you an exact date, but I'm hoping by the end of 2019 it'll be out.
Will it be available on places like Amazon?
Yes. Yes, and I pretty much guarantee there'll be a Blu-ray with a lot of extra features that are worth checking out, because there are hours and hours of interview footage that could not make the actual cut, so there's so much more than the final version.
So it's going to be a very loaded Blu-ray.
There you go. Very loaded, very loaded. Very informative to the fans, and they'll be very happy with it to know the full story of it.
Well, I want to thank you, Jason, and thank you, Stephen, for coming on the podcast. Have a good day, and good luck with your future projects.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having us on.
I'm here with Spencer Charnis, lead singer of the band Ice Nine Kills, and part of the great video series The Silver Scream, which is also Ice Nine Kills' latest album. How you doing today, Spencer?
I'm doing great. Excited to be back at Rockin' Shock. Best year ever.
Oh yeah, it has been the best year ever. I've been coming for a couple of years. Pretty much this has been the best year in turnout in a while.
I agree. A lot of people here this year.
How do you get your start in music?
I started the band back in high school as a cover band, mainly in the punk ska world of like Goldfinger, Real Big Fish, Less Than Jake, and then just kept at it for years.
Now, how do you come up with the name Ice Nine Kills?
Ice Nine is a reference to a Kurt Vonnegut book called Cat's Cradle, where the deadly substance that kills the entire world is called Ice Nine.
Ah, like the drug, pretty much.
It's a isotope that basically has the ability to freeze over any body of water. So if you put it in the ocean, all the oceans that were connected would freeze over and kill the world.
Now, what made you want to change from ska music to metal music?
I think it was just a natural progression of what music I liked at the time, but we still include a lot of the early influences of punk and ska in the band today. In some songs, we even have cameos from ska bands like Less Than Jake.
Yeah, I've noticed that, especially with your latest single as well, Is the End.
Yes, that was a great time and really fun to include Less Than Jake and Phoenix TX on that song.
Now, your latest album is The Silver Scream. How did you come up with the concept of the album?
Horror has always been very near and dear to my bloody heart. And so I thought it was time that we go full force into a conceptual record about horror. Thought it was the appropriate time.
Now, what are some of your favorite horror films since you went into a conceptual album about horror?
Other than the ones that are on The Silver Scream, I really like Silent Night, Deadly Night. Oh, wait, that's on it. Scream, American Psycho, Pet Sematary, So many. The Prowler, The Burning.
Now, on one of the album's tracks, Enjoy Your Sleigh, which is a homage to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, the track also features Sam Kubrick, the grandson of Stanley Kubrick. How did you make the connection to have Sam Kubrick to be your guest on Enjoy Your Sleigh?
We were touring in England with a band called Shields, and it turned out that the singer in the band, Sam, was Stanley Kubrick's grandson. So we became very good friends with them, and when it came time to do a song about The Shining, I thought it would be awesome to include him on the track.
Now, did he share any great memories of his father, Stanley, with you?
He told me that his grandfather was a really nice guy, and that he died when Samuel was pretty young, but that he definitely made a lasting impression on him.
You also have Stranger Things and Doctor Sleep actress and singer Chelsea Talmadge on the album as well for the track Love Bites. How did that collaboration come about?
We became friends, we had mutual friends, and I saw her singing one night at a karaoke bar, and I asked her to be part of the track because I thought she would be a fantastic addition to it. We needed a female vocalist, and it went great.
Now, did you know at the time that she was in Stranger Things?
I did. It was after the first season had already come out, and that was another factor in including her that I thought our fans would enjoy that cameo from a horror sci-fi kind of an angle.
Now, how did the concept for the videos in the Silver Scream come about?
I had an idea to do interweaving narrative throughout the videos, and I thought it would be cool to do it where I was playing myself, and I teamed up with Daniel Horahan, also known as Mouthguard, and we put it together.
Now, what was the toughest video to shoot out of the five?
I would say it is the end, just because of the intense makeup and contacts that I was wearing for pretty much 2 days straight.
Now, what was it like shooting the final climax to that video?
During the climax, we were all very hard. But it was a lot of fun to do.
Now, one of the things that I really liked about it, besides you in it, because you really do play a great psychopath.
Thank you. My mother said the same thing.
Was the fact that you also had a good actor playing the deranged, egotistic psychiatrist.
He was great.
Tell me about him.
He's a fantastic actor. Paul Taft is his name. And he was just a fantastic addition to the cast. He really has great comic timing, highly experienced, and he really provided great chemistry.
Speaking of actors, you also got to work with Ricky Dean Logan in Stabbing in the Dock. What was it like working with him?
He's fantastic. We actually met him at a convention in Massachusetts called ScareCon. And we just hit it off. He's a musician, and we ended up jamming with acoustic guitars that night and became good friends with him and asked him if he would be a part of the video, and he was great.
Now, how did you approach your role in those videos?
I definitely feel like I was influenced a little bit by Christian Bale's performance in American Psycho and Skeet Ulrich's performance in Scream. So I kind of took those as my cues in how to behave, and then tried to throw in some of my own ideas.
Now, one of the things I noticed you guys did very well was to get around the likenesses of Jason, Michael Myers, and so on. How did you guys do it?
We tried to operate in the area that's known as parody so that it wouldn't be infringing on the actual intellectual property of those films and franchises. And seems like we did pretty well because no one sued us yet.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Me too. Our lawyer is too. I think he was disappointed.
I know you had a fight with Disney over a shirt.
Yes, Mickey and I used to date back in the day, and I think Mickey was a bit pissed about that.
Typical Disney for you.
Yes, very Disney.
Now, will you use the same concept on your next album?
I'm not quite sure. Still deciding.
Now, you're coming out with a final cut version of the Silver Scream. What can everyone expect on that final cut edition besides the regular tracks from the Silver Scream?
So we've got 4 acoustic versions of the songs, and we've got some really great guests on 2 of them. On Stabbing in the Dark, we have Matt Heafy from Trivium doing vocals. And on Thank God It's Friday, which is based on Friday the 13th, we have the original Jason, Ari Lehman, who portrayed the young Jason in the first film when he jumps out of the water.
First Jason.
Yeah, first Jason. Yeah, so he sings on the track. We have a cover of Michael Jackson's Thriller. And a new song about Scream called Your Number's Up.
No music videos on this package?
We will have a music video / lyric video for Your Number's Up that we just finished wrapping that will be released most likely October 25th.
Okay, and also, you know, right now check out Stabbing in the Dark on YouTube, the acoustic version.
Yes, please do.
Now, what was it like just doing this like retro 60s, 70s thing with that acoustic version?
I thought it would be really creepy and something a bit different. I sort of gave them the idea that I liked Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun and how kind of retro and creepy and almost Tim Burton that video was as the reference.
Now, you're also the co-owner of Cleaver, where we're conducting this interview at.
Yes.
How did you find that company?
I wanted to do a company where some stuff that might not fit with Ice Nine Kills aesthetic would work. So it was kind of another outlet for creativity.
Now, what made you want to get into that business besides the creativity?
I always liked bands that had their own clothing lines. Like Blink 182 back in the day had Atticus and Famous Stars and Straps. Just seemed like a natural thing to do.
Now, finally, where can they find all the information on Ice Nine Kills and Cleaver?
For Ice Nine Kills, I would recommend ice9kills.com or follow our Instagram. And for Cleaver, salem666.com.
Well, thank you, Spencer, for coming on to my podcast. Have a good day and enjoy the rest of the convention.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
This is Carrie.
This is Billy.
This is Mr. Boat.
And we are from A Podcast from Beneath. You can catch us every Wednesday wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Don't forget, you can find Anthony T's Horror Show on social media, over on Facebook, Instagram, and Slasher app at Anthony T's Horror Show, on Twitter at Anthony T's Horror. If you liked this episode, you can subscribe to Anthony T's Horror Show over on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. You can also catch Anthony T's Horror Show over on DocDiscussions.com, where you can find my podcast and other podcasts on the Doc Discussions Network.
Finally, we've gotten to probably one of the most infamous rants in the history of this podcast. It is the worst horror anthology film of all time, Glenn Danzig's Veronica. Now, this film is really quite possibly the worst film ever made. It's definitely the worst horror anthology film ever made. It also has the worst
horror segment in an anthology film ever. There is nothing good about Glenn Danzig's Veronica. Case in point, this rant. As I go off for about almost 12 minutes, it is one of the longest rants about a film on the podcast ever. Now, in this edition of What Anthony T is Watching, it is a film that I've been wanting to watch for a long time. It has been an anticipated film that I've been wanting to talk about. It's a film I tried to get to last episode. And I was excited for this film for all the wrong reasons. Yes, for all the wrong reasons here. Because when I first heard about Glenn Danzig's Veronica, this film was being compared to Tommy Wiseau's The Room. Now, if you never heard of The Room before, that is one of the worst films ever made. So, when I read that Veronica was getting The Room type heat, I really needed to check this film out. Because I really needed to see this film. Because I really needed to test this film compared to the greatest guilty pleasure film of all time, Jason X. So that was pretty much the only real reason why I had any interest in this film. Because under no circumstances would I ever watch a film that is compared to Tommy Wiseau's The Room. Now, I did go into this film with an open mind, as like I do with every film I watch, hoping that this would be a very good film, hoping that everybody was just not seeing the film for what it is. Unfortunately, I can say this with such clarity, Glenn Danzig's Veronica is the worst horror anthology film of all time. And this was a film that I was hoping to like, because I have to admit, this film had some very good gothic imagery, but that's all this film has. Gothic imagery. Because this did not look like it resembled a film. I'll even go far to say this. This looked like a film that is unreleasable. Meaning, it's a film that distributors would never touch. And the only reason Veronica is being released, it's being released by a record company, Cleopatra Records, who've also dipped into the horror genre by releasing various other horror movies too. But also, Glenn Danzig is one of the artists on the Cleopatra Records music label. If he was some average indie filmmaker, nobody would distribute this film. Because, quite frankly, this film lacks a lot of things. First, this film lacks any sense of action. Everything in this film felt like you were watching a painting throughout the entire film. Each of the stories moved very slowly, and there was no sense of pacing. There was hardly any action in this film. It's just mind-boggling to watch a film from someone who has never, ever made a film in his life. Yes, he's made music videos, but filmmaking is a different animal. And it was like he was just putting anything down in the screenplay and just go from there. Because literally, in a screenplay, you need characters that are interesting. In this film, there is no characters that caught my attention. No characters that grabbed my interest. I don't know what Glenn Danzig was doing when he was writing the screenplay. Because, quite frankly, in order to have a film work and be scary and entertaining, you need characters who have more of a story, more personality. Every character in this film felt very dark and very gloomy. That is not how you make a movie. Another thing that really irked me about this film was the way that Glenn Danzig directs the acting in this film. Because the acting in this film is horrendous. Every actor in that film was just hitting one note. I was not interested in any of the characters. The first story felt very depressing. The second story was very dull. And kind of frankly very lifeless. Because seriously, your main protagonist is dull. Was dull. I cannot get into the character. If I can't get into the character, how am I going to get into the story? And the third one was just completely crap. Seriously. In fact, I'll even go on to say that third story, Drukaija, Contessa of Blood, is the worst segment in an anthology film ever. This story had no protagonist. This story felt like it was like the main character bathes in blood, kills another character, then bathes in blood again. That's what the story felt to me. When you have that in a story, it really kills a film. If you manage to survive the first two stories of this film, Drukaija, Contessa of Blood will do you in. Because that was flat out horrible. That just focuses on a main villain killing people. And that's it. Because you get no story in that segment. In fact, this whole film's main problem is that Glenn Danzig's screenplay does not develop anything. It doesn't want you to make you care for the protagonists. Or even make you care that this is actually a film. Because quite frankly, I've never seen a film, let alone an anthology film, where the screenplay is just non-existent. Because that's what it felt here. Because I really think Glenn Danzig did not even care about making his characters interesting. Instead, he's just going to throw everything on the screen and see what works. And you cannot do that with a film. Just throw out your ideas, throw out your vague stories, and see if it'll work. Don't get me wrong. I like Gene Roland. I like Jess Franco. But Glenn Danzig is neither Gene Roland or Jess Franco. Those guys, at least through their bizarreness, told a story. Glenn Danzig here just didn't even try to tell a story, as this film feels like it's just there for the brutal blood and gore, and that's it. Because there is no attempt to really make this any good. No wonder why this film has, get this, a 1.9 on IMDb. I'll say this again. A 1.9. Veronica is easily the worst film of the year. I don't think there's going to be any other film to top this film. Because this is quite frankly awful. Now, is this the greatest guilty pleasure film of all time? I don't think so. It will not be the greatest guilty pleasure film of all time. I'm sorry. You need to have action that's moving. over the top. This film has little to no action. It felt like I was watching paint dry, and that's why it gets sort of a guilty pleasure title on this film, because this is how you do not make a film. Because if you're going to have a film where the tone is very dark and bleak in each of your stories, if you're going to have a film where you're going to have acting that is just downright horrible, and if you're going to have a film that really just doesn't want to bring you in, then that is why Glenn Danzig's Veronica is the Room of Horror films. Because Glenn Danzig doesn't give you any scares. He doesn't give you any good acting. He doesn't even give you a film in which you can enjoy. Because this film felt like it was made for one person, and that was Glenn Danzig. Because this film is just downright awful, amateurish at times, and it's really one of the worst films, quite frankly, that I've seen in quite a while. This is like Battlefield Earth bad. This is like Dead Silence bad. Don't bother wasting your time with Glenn Danzig's Veronica, because either the first segment will get you to shut the film off, the second segment will get you to shut the film off, and if you make it to the worst segment in an anthology horror film ever, you're going to shut it off by the third segment, because everything in this film is boring. It has great imagery, and that's it. It is one of those films where we really need the bad movie police. Because, quite frankly, this film should have never been released at all. It is just a complete and utter mess. See you in January, Glenn Danzig. T's Horror Show on Facebook. I'm currently wrapping up the 31 days of Halloween, as it will be wrapped up this Saturday. So I hope everybody's been enjoying the 31 days of Halloween over on Anthony T's Horror Show on Facebook. If you like the show, subscribe to the show on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Stitcher. With that, I want to thank you for listening to this best of episode. Have a good day, stay safe, and support indie horror.